I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, a project of Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. This discussion is part of American Graduate, our ongoing community conversation about the importance of education and setting students on the path to graduation and success in life. My guests are Cynthia Baker, clinical professor of law and the founding director of the Program on Law and State Government, Heather Kinzer, a law student, Marcus McGee, also a law student, and Rhea Shaw, lawyer for the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Send an email to nolimitswfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, state government efforts toward expungement reform. This is a project of Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests here in the studio are Heather Kinzer, who is a law student, I'm supposed to say fellow, I understand, with this project. Also, Marcus McGee, who also is a law student and a fellow. Cynthia Baker, who is clinical professor of law and the founding director of the Program on Law and State Government and the faculty advisor for Heather and Marcus. And we're joined by phone by Rhea Shaw, who's a lawyer for the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia and has written extensively on the way states handle expungement of juvenile offenses. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. Cynthia, I'm going to start with you. Why don't you talk with us about what this project is, rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, and then we'll drill down from there.
Sure. The Program on Law and State Government Fellowship affords two law students a co-curricular opportunity to explore an issue facing state governments for a calendar year instead of the usual academic semester. And this year, Heather and Marcus have focused on this school-to-prison pipeline, that is, how some state laws, state policies, and school policies work to keep youth in juvenile justice systems and out of school instead of the other way around. It's been a really interesting year thus far. They started their work in January, and we're really looking forward to our symposium to our community on Friday, September 25th.
So, Heather and Marcus, I think that's your cue. She set the table for you. So, talk to us a little bit about what we mean by the school-to-prison pipeline. What obviously it is a metaphor of sorts. We don't have an actual literal pipe that we put, but how what we're talking about, the problem that you're studying.
Children often enter into this metaphorical pipeline by getting in trouble in the school with SROs or teachers, and eventually that leads them to the juvenile justice system. And their involvement with that is further complicated a lot of times by their probation and the rules that surround that, which eventually leads them into the adult system and possibly into prison.
Marcus, how many people are we talking about, say, in central Indiana or in Indiana who are affected by this?
Well, we're looking at all of the institutions in Indianapolis that have school resource officers. There's not a specific number that we've been able to identify according to the National Association of School Resource Officers, but in general, you are seeing that there are over 17,000 school resource officers nationwide, and they individually have an impact on the schools. So it just depends on the population of the particular school district in regard to how many SROs there will be in that school district, and similarly, how many students will be affected.
And Rhea, could you put this problem in some sort of, this situation in some sort of national perspective?
Sure. So I think that one of the biggest things that we understand about the school-to-prison pipeline is that it really results in greater consequences than I think many people understand it to result in. Having children go for offenses that might ordinarily be taken care of by school personnel and being funneled into the justice system as a result of those offenses or those activities, they are then put into the system where they can penetrate deeper and deeper into the system, and what results from that are a large number of consequences from their involvement in the system, both direct consequences while they're involved in the system as it relates to their disruption in education and their family life and everything else that's happening to them as teenagers at that moment in time, but then even later in life, years beyond, because their records of their time in the juvenile court system prohibit them from engaging in a lot of opportunities as they grow into adulthood.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline. It is a project of Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. And I should say that this show is part of our continuing conversation about the importance of education and putting students on the path to graduation. The conversation is called American Graduate for obvious reasons. If you'd like to join that conversation, be part of it today, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Marcus, give me an example of a young person who has been pulled into this school-to-prison pipeline. What's a typical starting point, and walk me through some of the steps of how this student, this allegorical student, I guess, would move from being in a classroom to finding his or her way into prison.
It would depend on the student, but in most instances, we're seeing students enter the system through what we know as status offenses. So those are offenses that, if committed by an adult, would not be a crime.
Like truancy.
Correct. So truancy. We are also seeing some additional things like students who are disrespectful in class, who are talking back, who might be tardy to class. Some of those offenses are becoming the responsibility of school resource officers in the disciplinary process. And as a result, we are seeing more dangerous responses to these actions. So, for example, there was an instance where one child had a temper tantrum in school because he or she did not particularly like the way the teacher was doing their course lesson. Normally, that would be something that we as people would say typify adolescence, that children throw temper tantrums and we just deal with them. But in these instances, we are seeing school resource officers take this response to the extreme, and when they are handcuffing these individuals and arresting them and actually formally charging them for things that we as lay people would believe not to be really serious offenses. So they are being arrested, they're being booked, they're being having mug shots taken. They're actually being introduced into the system, and what we see is that they are not being fully processed, because once they get to the court system, the judge looks at the charges and says, this is not something that we normally deal with. We are here to deal with criminal offenses, not disciplinary behavioral issues. In one of the letters released by the judge for Marion County's juvenile division, she even stated that 80% of her cases are cases that are disciplinary problems and not necessarily cases that she would normally find under her purview as a judge. So we're seeing a lot of people getting these arrest records for things that are so trivial, but they have so much dangerous effects on their future as productive members of society.
The student you just referenced, the one who was pulled into the system for throwing a temper tantrum, how old was this student?
There were two instances. There's one most recently in Kentucky. He was an 8-year-old boy. He was only handcuffed in the classroom, but he was subsequently released. But they nevertheless met with other members of the legal community and filed a lawsuit against that school resource officer and that school district because of the excessive force. Another case very similar happened in Florida for a 6-year-old girl. And this case, she was actually processed fully through the system, received a misdemeanor and a felony charge for a temper tantrum.
Rhea, I'm going to ask, again, since this is it sounds like a problem that is national in scope. How did we get to this point where we've got 6-year-olds being handcuffed in classrooms for situations? And I'll lead you a little bit on that. You can push back if you want to. I, I'm I'm curious as to how much of this also is a kind of response or reaction to our fears about school shootings and other kinds of violence. And we've talked with law enforcement officials on this program who have talked about the importance of addressing problems early before they escalate, what they call either gateway offenses or the lower level offenses, that they want to be proactive in dealing with those at the beginning. How much of this is a product of that kind of thinking?
Well, I think that you're right. You're on track in saying that it really is a product of the fear of things like school shootings. Much of these laws, these zero tolerance laws, as we refer to them, really do predate, however, the more recent school shootings and most recent outcry around safety in schools that we've heard about. But it's all coming from the gun-free Schools Act, and this is from years ago where there was zero tolerance policies implemented in schools where really anything that could be used as a weapon there was a zero tolerance policy where kids were immediately kicked out of school or referred to the justice system, and it's trickled down to turn into a much more an environment in many schools, especially many urban schools, where these policies still do exist, where these zero tolerance policies, whether it relates to bringing weapons in or actually behaviors against teachers, whether it's harassment or any other type of behaviors with teachers involved or school staff involved, result in zero tolerance policies, pushing kids out into the school, the justice system. And I think what Marcus said is correct in that much of this, these are disciplinary infractions that really can be dealt with by school personnel, but when it gets to the court system, sometimes, yes, it might just result in an arrest record, which in and of itself has several consequences, but sometimes it also can result in juvenile justice system involvement, and it can result in an adjudication. We have many more offenses that, like harassment or terroristic threats, that are used to charge kids that act out in classrooms. Many times these are manifestations of children's disabilities that result in their behavior in a classroom that can then lead to juvenile justice system involvement. And so there's really this is really something that we're seeing over and over again. And one of the things in Pennsylvania, my home state, we saw this play out in Northeast Pennsylvania in the Kids for Cash scandal, which you may have heard about, where a judge was sending children. He had gone to schools and he had talked to students at school saying that, you know, if you're doing something in your school that you're not supposed to be, if you're harassing a teacher or if you're doing anything in a school that you're not supposed to be, I have a zero tolerance policy. You're going to come in my courtroom and I'm going to put you away. And that's what he was doing. He was putting kids away and essentially accepting money for from the detention center, and that he was populating with his children in his courtroom.
Yeah, that was a national scandal.
Yeah, it was a national scandal, and it really stemmed from these types of zero tolerance policies.
If you were just joining us, we are talking about rupturing the school to prison pipeline. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can reach out to us by email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a caller who didn't want to go on the air did and just give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. This caller asked, what is a resource officer and what do resource officers do? Probably should have dealt with that. Heather, I'll throw that one to you.
School resource officers are police officers that are in the actual school buildings. With IPS, they're part of the Indianapolis Police Department. In some schools, they're just security officers. It kind of depends on which school system you're in. But essentially, they're utilized to promote school safety and to deal with children that need more help than what ideally should be available in the school.
Are they universal? I mean, are they in every school now? Or Marcus, you're shaking your head.
They aren't in every school.
Okay.
They are in a lot of schools, and especially in larger urban districts.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline. State Government Efforts Toward Expungement Reform. That's a project of the McKinney School of Law. My guests are Heather Kinzer, who is a law student and fellow working on the project, Marcus McGee, who is also a law student and fellow working on the project, Cynthia Baker, who is a clinical professor of law and the founding director of the program on law and state government. She's also the faculty advisor for Heather and Marcus. And by phone, we're talking with Rhea Shaw, who's a lawyer for the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, state government efforts toward expungement reform. That's a project of Indiana University's McKinney School of Law. My guests are Heather Kinzer and Marcus McGee. They're both law students and fellows working on the project. Cynthia Baker, who is their faculty advisor and a clinical professor of law, as well as the founding director of the program on law and state government. And Rhea Shaw, a lawyer for the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia, who has written extensively on the way states handle expungement of juvenile offenses. Got a Facebook question from a listener named Donna, and if you'd like to join the conversation by Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Donna says, are your guests working with any of the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiatives, JDA, in many Indiana counties or with the juvenile justice strategists at the Indiana Judicial Center? Cynthia, I'll throw that one to you first.
We are aware of JDAI and its excellent work in the state of Indiana and really across the country. We are also working with the Children's Policy and Law Initiative of Indiana. But to that end, I'm not sure about the second organization that you mentioned, although it sounds like something we should definitely look into.
Donna's, it says, the with the Juvenile Justice Strategists at the Indiana Judicial Center.
No, but we are aware that the
Donna, they are taking notes right now, so you can rest assured.
Yeah. And that our Chief Justice of our Indiana Supreme Court has been a real leader in this issue, and I'm sure Chief Justice Rush would help us make some connections to that end.
I want to ask, and I'll throw this out to anyone. I mean, in terms of the research on this, is there any evidence that these kinds of early interventions, if the strategy is, you know, on the surface, what they call a more holistic approach to this, trying not waiting until the murder has been committed, but trying to, you know, the image they always use is trying to step in when the window is broken or something like that, has had success? Is it able to prevent, or does, I'm not articulating this question well, but, or is the result simply that as soon as that child is pulled into the system, bad things follow? Who wants to take that one first? All right, Cynthia.
I would say the evidence that I've seen suggests, unfortunately, the opposite, that these well-meaning policies, zero-tolerance policies, and the harsh negative effects of labeling kids and the record keeping for schools seem directly tied to lower graduation rates rather than positive effects.
I've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Gary. Says, can anyone tell me if there's any evidence indicating the students who graduate or not are then being forced into a homelessness scenario due to either the parents or the need to get away from criminals?
I think that it's fair to look at the collateral consequences that can happen from these adjudications. Sometimes it can prevent a child from being able to, or a young adult, actually entire families, from being able to get Section 8 housing. And it certainly can be a deterrent. And
probably ought to explain to people what Section 8 housing is.
Section 8 housing is federally subsidized housing, so families that need assistance with living arrangements or a place to live are able to get government assistance with that. And having a juvenile adjudication can keep an entire family out of that system.
Marcus, I think you mentioned earlier that one of the – a juvenile judge had said that 80% of the cases that came before her were disciplinary offenses rather than, you know, what we would consider law enforcement.
Correct.
Traditional. Can we extrapolate a number from that? I mean, can we get to, if it's 80%, do we know how large her caseload is? I'm trying to get an idea of how large a problem this is just in the number of people who are affected, number of students who get pulled into the pipeline. He's looking toward Heather, so Heather is the one who has the answer.
The most recent statistics that I've seen on juvenile arrest is about 2 million in the country. That's 2 million a year. And 95% of the arrest, the adjudication, so not just the arrest, but the actual things that go to adjudication are nonviolent.
Okay. So they still could be, you know, crimes in the traditional sense, in that it you know, presumably it could be
battery.
Yeah, well, or if it's nonviolent, stealing a purse when no one's looking or something like that. But presumably it means that they aren't the kind of offenses that most of our fears about school violence we refer to. Rhea, do you have numbers on that, on the idea of how many of these students are being pulled into the system for what are, you know, classically would have been considered school discipline problems rather than law enforcement problems?
Unfortunately, I don't really off the top of my head. I think that it's a larger number than what we might imagine, but I really don't have a firm number.
So if we assumed, this is dangerous, journalists doing math. if we assume, though, using that 2 million figure annually, and again, this is a huge assumption, 80%, if we knock that down, it's probably safe to say that, you know, hundreds of thousands of young people every year are being pulled into the legal system through this school to prison pipeline.
What
are the consequences for those students?
I would say that is an accurate assessment. One of the things that I think is going to be great about our symposium is that we have a keynote speaker, Kyungji Kate Ree, from the Center for New Leadership and Urban Solutions in New York, and she will speak to similar issues that we are discussing here today in regards to a large number of individuals in the state of New York are being pulled into the system but are not necessarily being processed for actual criminal offenses. So she will speak about the number of collateral consequences that she's seeing as well. And one of the issues is the age limit. So depending on your jurisdiction, that determines what a juvenile is. So that can be 16, you can be 17, you can be 18, and that changes. So depending on that, you can encapsulate more individuals. So that's why the specific number...
How does that change? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I...
It just depends on how the jurisdiction defines what a juvenile is. So traditionally, you can do that. You become an adult at 18 if you're a female and a male of 21, but different statutes define what a juvenile is for the purposes of the law.
Okay.
So that can differentiate based on jurisdiction, based on how they feel their adults and their juveniles vary.
So that I make sure that everyone's understanding this, does that mean then that someone can be a juvenile in one county and not a juvenile in another county, and they commit the same offense?
Not necessarily counties, but states.
Oh, states.
So different
okay.
states operate differently in regards to what they categorize. For example, it's not a very big dichotomy. So one state might say 16 and the other might say 17, but that increases the number exponentially. So when you're looking for specific
numbers. What's a big difference if you're 16?
Exactly. Yeah. So when you're looking for that specific number, it's kind of difficult to allocate specific numbers because we don't know which medium they're using, the 16-year-olds or the 17-year-olds.
Cynthia, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to note that I did recover from my notes some statistics out of Marion County from 2012-13. In their suspensions, some records that were reported to the mayor's office included that most of the out-of-school suspensions were for the category of, quote, other, 27%. And the next category, 22%, was defiance. And those were the number one, number two, and then after that became fighting and battery. But the very first two categories are these nonviolent, non-criminal offenses that are taking children out of the educational system and putting them in the juvenile justice system, contributing in one of many ways to the school-to-prison pipeline.
We are talking about the school-to-prison pipeline here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Gordon has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering about the young man that committed murder up there in Fishers. I knew he was severely autistic and a one-on-one with the teachers when he was in primary school, but now I've heard that he's, you know, been found sound to stand trial. And even though when they were investigating it, here was a man riding his bicycle around with the policeman. You know, he wasn't exactly a hard catch. And I just wonder if areas and news that they want to see a trial and they want to pipeline somebody who I think is probably mentally ill, you know, right into the system, and then, you know, we'll, you know, keep them for the rest of their life. I can just put it on over to whoever wants to comment on that.
Thanks very much for the call, Gordon, and the question. Cynthia, I'll throw that one to you first.
I'm not sure about the exact question, but that was a very extreme tragedy, and I don't think that's the gravamen of Heather and Marcus's look here at the school-to-prison pipeline for that kind of extreme murder. If the question was, should the teachers have known and dealt with this somehow differently to prevent the murder, but I didn't quite hear that question.
Well, or whether, as I took it, and Gordon, feel free to jump onto Facebook and correct me if I'm reinterpreting this, it was more whether there is pressure within the system, since we define success, at least in political terms for many prosecutors, by saying, okay, you've got to show this many convictions or whatever. That's the scorecard we use for you. And we can say that we're demonstrating success by the number of arrests, because saying that we've prevented crimes or whatever is like proving a negative. It's difficult to do. Heather, you wanted to jump in, I noticed.
I'd like to first start by saying condolences to the Kim family. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, we're looking at nonviolent offenses for our general research and in our symposium. I would like to mention, though, that I think that part of the media pressure that he's mentioning is one of the topics that I will be covering. It has to do with confidentiality of records. And in our state, we have a statute that allows the public, that allows public access to records of juveniles. And if those records were better protected, then the general public probably wouldn't have the information about this child that they have.
So to some degree, what we're saying is that some of the problem could be solved then by reaffirming, you know, a separate status for juveniles. Is that
by reaffirming the confidentiality and the privacy that they need to be rehabilitated properly?
We are talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline here on No Limits. Mitch, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I was a teacher in Indiana for 36 years, and I wonder if there anybody talking to the teachers, because that is their primary source of information. The teachers are on the front lines, and they know what's happening in the classrooms, and they deal with these students every day. I don't agree that somebody should be handcuffed unless they're a threat to the students or to the teachers or somebody, but I do think that we're not communicating enough with the teachers.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Heather. Thank you.
Thank you for your service. I'm a veteran teacher of 15 years as well, which is obviously a shorter amount of time than you. I do think that we need to have much more communication between teachers and what's going on in classrooms with policymakers. I think that's essential to the future legislation of our state. And just in general, working with these problems, it needs to be wraparound services. And we do need to have input from teachers on what's going to work in the classroom, rather than having legislators necessarily tell us what's going to work in the classrooms.
And I should say right here, because that's sort of a cue, Heather, that you delivered for me, that this program is part of our continuing conversation about education and the importance of graduation rates. That continuing conversation, community conversation, is American Graduate, and it's a product of a partnership of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, this station, and many other partners, to put young people on the path to graduation and successful lives. Should ask here, we've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named James who says, I am a retired sergeant from the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. I was a supervisor of our youth services education unit and taught a high school-based program called GREAT, Gang Resistance Education and Training. Have your guests heard of this program, and do they know if programs like this have any effect on reducing crime? Marcus.
Yes, I have heard of those programs. Actually, in my elementary school in Chicago, Illinois, we had a similar program. It was the DARE program, so the drug version of the program that was just recently mentioned. Those programs do assist in the respect that they notify the children of what things can lead to them being arrested. So selling drugs, being involved in gang activity. But along with the police officers being in school for those particular programs, they also have a greater capability of being alerted to other offenses within the specific school. So if they're there to talk about drugs and the prevention of those drugs, or to prevent gang data, or to prevent activity in gangs, they're also able to observe any other criminal activity that would occur in the school, or any of the activity that would occur in the school that might be a disciplinary issue but could turn criminal based on the perspective of the specific school resource officer.
Rhea, I want to ask a question about some of the incentives we have built now into law enforcement, specifically the idea of privatizing prisons and creating for-profit prisons. Does that create an incentive to fill those prisons with bodies, and does that have any role in creating this situation?
I don't know if it necessarily has a role in creating the situation. I think that there is a danger of incentivizing populating the prisons when they are for-profit. Actually exactly what happened here again with the Kids for Cash scandal, mm-hmm. is that they were for-profit private prisons that the judges participated in, received money for a sort of assisting in finding the building the facility. But private prisons aren't necessarily an issue if they're private nonprofit prisons, because, you know, the state can only do so much. In a lot of places, Pennsylvania, we rely on private facilities quite a bit, but the for-profit is where there is a danger of incentivizing populating them and keeping them populated.
Marcus, you look like you wanted to say something. No?
No, sir.
Okay. Cynthia?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I think it's worth noting, and we were discussing this over a break, the double and triple ironies of this problem. And one is, we're this country with, some would say, the greatest educational system in the world. We've got 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's incarcerated population. And the striking fact that in 2010, Forbes indicated that Texas uses fourth grade reading scores to predict prison beds 10 years out.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, state government efforts toward expungement and reform. We have been talking so far about all the things that aren't working. I think in this next segment, I'd like to focus on ways that we might be able to rupture that system and move it forward. I am John Krall. I am talking with Heather Kinzer, Marcus McGee, Cynthia Baker, and Rhea Shaw. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline, state government efforts toward expungement reform. That's a project of IU's McKinney School of Law. I'm talking with Heather Kinzer and Marcus McGee, who are law students and fellows working on the project, as well as Cynthia Baker, who is their faculty advisor, as well as being a clinical professor of law and the founding director of the program on law and state government, and Rhea Shaw, a lawyer for the Juvenile Law Center, who has written extensively on the way states handle expungement of juvenile offenses. I said before the break, before we went to the break, that we talk an awful lot about the ways this system is not working, that we've got, you know, among other things, six-year-olds being handcuffed in their classrooms for throwing temper tantrums and all of that. Are there places in this country where we see evidence that this pipeline has been ruptured, that people have been able to intervene and do so successfully? My question would be, where are those places, and two, how are we defining success? I'll throw that one to Marcus first.
There are a number of different states that have been excellent at this. For example, New York State has been developing some programs to better attend to the issues of the juvenile. And we have, in Indiana, even mimicked some of those things. So right now, Indiana has a statute pending that would increase the training, the basic training of school resource officers so they can better attend to the needs of students. Currently, right now, school resource officers are under the training of normal police officers, which means they have a requirement of 600 hours of training. In order to become a school resource officer, they require an additional 40 hours. One recommendation has been to increase that training. The current statute that is pending in the legislature is asking for better training as it relates to mental illness, dealing with students who have disabilities, and things of that nature.
Heather, you're unusual in that you have experience, obviously, as a classroom teacher. So you've seen this situation up close. I'm going to ask a question, and, you know, if it's an uncomfortable one, how much of this is a product of the fact that teachers now are asked to do so many different things and that the burdens, the expectations for them have increased so much that, to some degree, if they're going to be judged by student performance, it does create an incentive to say, okay, you got a student who's not going to perform, get them out of the classroom. I mean, you create an incentive for that.
I certainly think that the high-stakes testing is affecting how the classroom works. We're no longer teaching to the whole child, and we're starting at younger and younger ages to get the academic piece there when we're missing the social piece. As a classroom teacher, it's very difficult to lose time to a student that you're having to discipline. And so it would certainly be easier to remove the child from the class so that you can teach. It's kind of painful for me to answer that, because as a good teacher, understanding how a good classroom should work, that's not how it should work. And I believe that there's teachers out there that can reach children without putting them out of the classroom. But I think that the overall effect is kind of what you were implicating, that we need to be able to teach to the standards to be able to get the kids ready for the test. And so no holds bar on anything else. We're going to work on that, because that's where they're getting assessed.
We are talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline here on No Limits. Anita, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I agree with the last caller. I am a social worker. And what we're finding, particularly in the child welfare area, is many of the children that get in trouble come from challenged homes, and that they experience a lot of trauma that ends up showing in school as disciplinary issues. So they may be related to what happened at home or someplace else before they get to school. So my question is, has anybody thought about, instead of increasing resource officers, to increase social workers who could deal with the social issues the last caller was talking about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Marcus just about leapt out of his chair when you said that, Anita. I will throw that question to him. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. Marcus.
Thank you, Anita, for that question. That is an actual area that I've been researching for some time now. Right now, we see that school resource officers act as a resource to the school, but in this program, I'm advocating for the creation of a position that would act as a resource to the student. We have temporarily termed that a school resource counselor, someone who looks after the best interests of the student. So that person would work in conjunction with other mental health professionals, such as the school's counselors, school psychologists, and school social workers, to address disciplinary issues in lieu of putting them through the criminal justice system. I think that if we create that position, we can actually be that resource for the student. So if, for example, a student is unable to go to school on time and as a result has a truancy charge, we can work with that student to find some means of transportation to school. If a student is constantly being tardy because they don't have sufficient food, we can probably work with them to figure out, oh, well, we can get you a subsidized meal plan that the school offers. So we need to find someone who I submit to you is a school resource counselor to work not only with the schools, but work with the school resource officers and the students and the parents collectively to address the issues, as opposed to putting these children in the criminal justice system. I believe we can attack the issue if we remain in-house as opposed to taking it out-house.
Heather, I'm going to ask you a question here that is just patently unfair, and I'll acknowledge that. I'm going to ask you to speak for all teachers everywhere. To some degree, but you know, is that the kind of step that teachers would welcome, having an alternative to the, you know, to the school resource officer, someone, you know, that they can move the, it strikes me that what Mark is talking about here is kind of a halfway step here. If the child is disruptive in the classroom, you can move the child out of the classroom to some degree, but into a counseling rather than a law enforcement situation. Am I understanding what you're talking about here correctly, Marcus?
What you would do is, in lieu of starting that process of
law enforcement,
you would try to work with the teacher as well as this person to identify the actual problem, as opposed to just jumping straight to the conclusion.
Okay.
I believe that teachers are always looking for the best interest of the child and the community, and that teachers will use any resource that's made available to them to meet those interests. So, yes, I would believe that children, or that teachers, would welcome being able to support and wrap around kids in any way, families as well, in any way that they could, to make the child a success.
We're talking here about figuring out ways to keep students from being drawn into, young people being drawn into, what we're calling the school-to-prison pipeline. It is a problem that affects hundreds of thousands of kids in the United States every year. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Bruno has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bruno, welcome to the program.
Sir, thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a very unique situation. I have two sets of children. One set of children I raised from infancy, from their being a baby, and the second set I did not. And I did notice that the children that I had a participation in their lives for all their lives with the mother were successful, whereas my children that were not raised by me, had no father image in their lives, got in trouble. And what I was wondering, why isn't there some sort of program where there's a legislation that will force the parent and the child to face their issues together and work, and where you could pound out? Because I wished someone had been in a position to pound some sense into my head as a kid having children. That would have helped my children along the way, but there it wasn't anything, and nothing that I know of right now.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Bruno, and I hope things do work out for your children. Cynthia.
There is a national initiative, the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative, that really does focus on these wraparound programs such as functional family therapy and wraparound services and peer court and, again, in-school responses instead of shifting the child out of the classroom into the juvenile detention area. And the JDAI placements throughout the country are numerous. I believe there's a couple of model or close to model ones even in the state of Indiana. And it just takes a lot of time. And I spoke recently with another law student who worked with JDAI, and she said that was the hardest part of her work, was working with the families of the kids in these situations, because a lot of times, unfortunately, the parents are not receptive to hearing ways they can improve being parents.
We are talking about rupturing the school-to-prison pipeline here on No Limits. James, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Hi. What's on your mind?
The question I have is, I had heard that officials use third-grade test scores to determine the number of prison beds that will be needed in the future, and I'd wondered if your panelists had heard that or if there's any truth to that rumor.
Actually, I think Cynthia made reference to it. It was fourth grade in one case. But thanks very much for the call and the question, James. Cynthia, please.
Yeah, I was just going to repeat that there was a Forbes article that ran in 2010 that looked at the economics of connecting reading scores to prison beds.
So, and how did – I'll throw this one to either Rhea or Cynthia. Why do they use the reading scores? Because those are predictors of school –
because, according to another report from the Department of Justice, over 70% of the people in American prisons cannot read above a third grade level. And so if you put those two statistics together, you can draw some pretty straight economic lines.
I've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Paul who says, would curriculum that includes coping skills, conflict resolution, and interpersonal communication help? Rhea, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Help in the sense of keeping kids out of the system?
Yeah.
You know, I think that there are some efforts toward, this is not, my area of expertise necessarily, but there are some efforts toward introducing conflict resolution and other types of diversion programs in schools where kids are kept out of the juvenile justice system and kept out of court involvement. So whether it's through teen courts or other types of youth court programs or other diversion programs, I think that those are some ways that we can certainly keep kids out of the system and ensure that their records don't follow them throughout the course of their entire lives. As to the direct curriculum, I think that there's been some studies showing that curriculum in civics and other type of communications might be helpful, but I'm not 100% sure that that's there's a lot of research out there on this.
Heather.
I'm not going to speak so much to the research aspect of it. Kind of back to that just No Child Left Behind and the legislation surrounding that. As long as we are assessing teachers on math scores and reading scores, there isn't going to be time in the day for them to cover those areas adequately.
I've gotten a Facebook question from Allison, which is interesting. And if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. She says, I suspect there is a perspective that the school-to-prison trend is occurring in more urban minority school districts. Is that true, or are the more affluent school districts also engaging in this practice? Where is your research taking you so far on that? Is it an across-the-board situation, or is it one that is focused more on urban areas? Cynthia?
My research, as I've tried to keep up with my law students this year, shows that the school-to-prison pipeline most definitely runs more strongly through economically depressed neighborhoods and failing schools.
So is it let me, if I can take a further question then from Allison's question here and say, is poverty the denominator? Because when we talk about poverty in this country and poor schools, we tend to focus on urban schools, but in fact, there are many poor rural schools, too. Do we find this school-to-prison pipeline in poor rural schools, or is it largely an urban phenomenon? I'll throw it to you, Marcus.
The research has demonstrated that they are prevalent in both, but definitely more visible in urban settings. What we're seeing is that all of these things work together in a totality to negatively impact the juvenile. So, for example, if we're looking at someone who is low on the socioeconomic scale, they have fewer things that would assist them in, for example, attending school. Like if you have to get to school on time, if you have to provide lunch for yourself, if you have to be a student who has an active parent who has to assist in the homework and things of that nature. So if you are living in a low socioeconomic status, if you are the child of a one-parent household, all of those things work together to the detriment of the child. And what I suggest is that we need to be aware of those issues so that we can better attend to them in school, as opposed to punishing the child for those deficiencies in his or her life.
I've gotten a Facebook question from a regular listener named Marion, and I'm going to take the liberty of compressing it just a bit. And she's asking if we see evidence that discipline and students being pulled into this school to prison pipeline has a racial component, whether they are disproportionately African American or minority. Heather, I see you nodding your head, so I'm going with you.
Yes, there's certainly correlations between being in a minority group and being pulled into the school to prison pipeline.
Yeah, Marion is said in her Facebook message that it could be as much as 7 times more frequently. Is that reflective, Cynthia? Now you're nodding your head, so I'm going to go with you.
Rhea,
nodding head doesn't work so well.
Rhea might be another resource on this as well.
Rhea, you got about 30 seconds. Is that the case, or is it like a 7-to-1 ratio?
That sounds about right. I'm not quite sure exactly, but yeah, it's definitely a much larger percentage of youth of color that are pulled into the school, into the justice system from school referrals.
And is that the case nationally, or are there breakdowns where it's worse in certain parts of the country? I realize I'm asking you a complicated question, only giving you about 15 seconds to answer it.
I think it's the case nationally, and I think that what we need to continue to impress upon policymakers and people that are thinking about this is that it's not just that initial contact, it's the rest of their lives that this is going to be affecting them.
Well, I'm afraid that will have to be the last word. We have run out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank my guests, Heather Kinzer, Marcus McGee, Cynthia Baker, and Rhea Shaw. I've enjoyed talking with all of you, and I've learned a lot from every one of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Certainly. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Also like to thank our listeners. I apologize. We could not get to every question or comment. I'm hoping our guests will come back and we can continue the conversation at some point. I also would like to invite all of you to come back on Tuesday when we are going to be talking with former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith about what he's been doing since he left office and reminiscing about his years in office. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.